Thank you for downloading the IA podcast. The episode you're about to listen to was originally featured as a video on the IA's YouTube channel, IA London. But we've taken the audio and we've turned it into a podcast so that you can listen on the go. Enjoy.
How are you doing? This is another episode of The Swift Half with Snowden. With me, Christopher Snowden. This week, I am broadcasting, not live, but I'm broadcasting from 2 Lord North Street, the home of the Institute of Economic Affairs. Thank you very much for joining us again. As always, we have a special guest, and this time it is none other than Henry Dimbleby, who is the author of The National Food Strategy. This is part 2, The Plan, and also a co-founder of the Leon restaurant chain. Henry, how are you doing? Thanks for joining us.
Very well, thanks for having me.
Now, we don't agree on everything, do we, when it comes to the nanny state?
No, but we have. I've been incredibly grateful for your time in building this up, and we have kind of to'd and fro'd ideas, and I think it is complicated. I think it is not one of the kind of things I was trying to do was start at very first principles and work from there. So I'm sure that at some level there are things that we can agree on, and then the further down we go towards recommendation of taxation, I think we'll probably begin to differ at some point.
Because you came here, when was it, 3 years ago or so, when you were doing your initial research, and we spoke for, I don't know, an hour or so, and then you ignored everything I said.
I didn't, actually. And I spoke to Ryan Bourne as well. So I think that what we talked about is, when is it acceptable for the state to intervene? And we discussed kind of few principles. So at the very top, the question is there a market failure at all? So, and on health, the question is, some people would say the only market failure on health is caused by the fact that the way in which we fund the NHS. Yep. So because the NHS is not funded by each one of us, my bad eating impacts on your tax, and therefore, you say you do something about it. Some people would say, well, if we each paid for our own healthcare, that wouldn't be an issue. But anyway, that's where we are. So you start at that level. Is there a problem? You then get into, and you can be convinced there is or there isn't, you then get into, should the state intervene? And then we had the discussions about, is intervention better than no intervention? So are actually the interventions that you put in place going to be successful? And if they are going to be successful, are they going to cause more benefit than they don't? And so you kind of go on down that route,
which is very sensible, and it's I don't see it any different to any other public policy question where you ask, first of all, what's the problem you're trying to solve? Secondly, is it the government's business to be solving it, or is this a private problem? And I would argue with obesity is basically a private problem. But there could be a market failure, there could be negative externalities. I think, you're right, the most commonly mentioned one is it's costing. I don't mind if people want to eat themselves to death, but why should I have to pay for it? But if you look at the figures, I mean, aside from the fact that obese people pay taxes as well, so it's not as if they're completely free riding on this. You look at the figures, actually, we did some research at the IEA, found the net cost to be pretty negligible, really. And other research has actually shown there's a overall saving. Let me ask you this. If you could be convinced that there wasn't a net cost to the health service or to the taxpayer in any way, would you not think we need to worry about it?
Yeah, so I tell you, where I came out was, first of all, looking at the whole system, like the problems of the food system. There are two big problems. One is the harm it's doing to the environment. The other is the harm it's doing to health. They're not actually connected. People trying to connect them, but they're not very strongly connected. On the health side, I was convinced, and you can go into the, we've kind of to'd and fro'd in evidence, you've been very helpful on that. I was convinced that there was a big problem in terms of the scale of the harms that it was causing and the cost to the NHS, and that this was caused by our appetite, our evolved appetite, which particularly in some of us responds enthusiastically towards certain kinds of foods. Mm-hmm. And not surprisingly, food companies, not because they're malicious or trying to kill children, they've marketed and put more R&D into those foods, and that's made a certain proportion of people eat more. Companies will put more money in response, and you get a kind of reinforcing circle, a vicious circle.
What kind of
circle.
Foods are we talking about?
So it's interesting. I think the evidence is unclear on this. So a lot of some people would say it's ultra processed. I think where the evidence is pretty clear is that calorie dense foods low in insoluble fiber, which most ultra processed foods happen to be, you seek them out, you eat more and more quickly just because they're calorie dense and they satiate you less. And
so
you
give me some examples. I know people watching will be thinking, what is ultra processed food?
So basically, you know, the biggest issues are
sweets,
chocolate, ice cream, biscuits. Those are like, and then you're moving down into a level now where there are some kind of foods that are very sweet, kind of some of the processed foods. So some sauces, curries, etc., now very sweet and very sugary. So they'd move into that. But basically, it's not rocket science. I think it may be the case. So ultra processed. Some people say it's the processing that causes the problems or
how
some of the problems.
How would that work?
Well, there are two ways in which people think it works. So what is definitely the case is if you look at, there's some amazing work being done by an American physicist called Laszlo Barabasi. If you take an ultra-processed lasagna, so one that's been made in a factory, probably at slightly higher pressures, heats, but also with ingredients chosen to go through the process well to be cost-effective, and you make exactly the same lasagna at home.
With exactly the same ingredients?
No one's done it with exact same ingredients, but very similar ingredients. At the high level, they can have exactly the same chemical composition. But there are about 23,000 chemicals in that go into foods, and at a lower level, their chemical signature can look very different. But who knows? Well, at the moment, that's where the ultra-processed people think it's going to go, that there is some relationship with the biome inside your stomach and the complexity of food. But none of that is yet proven. What is the case is that the processed stuff tends to be more calorie dense, more sugary.
But a lot of the ones you mentioned, like biscuits and cakes, for example, they've been around for centuries. People make them in their homes. Are you saying that they're worse if they've been ultra-processed rather than just cooked by somebody?
No, not necessarily.
But there are now
20, you can buy 28 different kinds of Kit Kat in this country. And, you know, in a normal supermarket, you might be able to buy two kinds of cabbage if you were lucky. You know, the point is there is more money to be made.
You could provide 50 different types of cabbage.
You could, but there's not the money.
Type of Kit Kat and I'll still be buying the Kit Kat.
This is not what's nudging me. Exactly. So the point is that's just where the money's going, understandably. And that has got to a stage where it's causing problems. And actually, if you talk to the CEOs, there's a real difference between talking to the kind of Food and Drink Federation. I don't know, do you know Ian Wright? So who I really like, he's great. But his job is to deny that problem. If you talk to the CEOs privately of pretty much all of the retailers, and in fact the fast-moving consumer goods companies, people who make Mars bars, Kit Kats, etc., they recognise the problem. So they recognise that they are being sucked into providing more and more of that stuff. And they don't think, they say, well, if we stop doing it, then someone else will just do it.
Right, how about this for a proposition? If you are trying to lose weight or you don't want to put a lot of weight on, don't eat Mars bars, cakes and biscuits and ice creams and these things. Isn't this just common sense? And if people aren't going to do that, what hope have we got that nudges from the government are going to change anything?
Well, so I don't think nudges will. So if you look at...
Oh, bans then.
Yeah, so I think it is about how your appetite responds to the environment. So some of us, you clearly have an appetite that is naturally slimming, and whereas I have an appetite where I have to resist. I'm constantly working on my weight, and I've become... you begin to notice hunger and how it works, etc. And actually, if you look at people eating ad libitum, so without thinking about it, people eat different amounts. People also have different amounts of hunger hormones going into their body. So people have different appetites. And the problem is that when you're constantly being marketed this stuff, when this stuff is everywhere, it interacts pretty badly, as you can see from the increase in weight over time, with people's evolved appetite. And that is causing a problem. So it's the environment. You know, in the 40s, you were, I'm not sure if you've been into recently, I don't know, probably the worst is Marks and Spencer's. Marks and Spencer's got kind of amazing, like, it's like a kind of, you know, those mazes you used to go at stately homes. You used to go visit a stately home and you'd pay an extra quid to go into the maze. And you kind of had to go work through it to get your way out. The Marks and Spencer's checkouts now are kind of, sometimes you do a double dog leg through just endless
sweets
and crisps and cakes. Some people are better, some people are worse. But, and funny enough, Tesco's did some work where they reconfigured their stores, some stores, and they sold immediately much less of this stuff. They made less money, but they sold a lot less of it. So it's just, there
is... So that is a nudge. That's a classic example.
That is a nudge, but it is not a nudge by government because Tesco's lost money doing it. So it's hard for them to do it independently in a competitive environment. So that's what we argue, which is it has to be pre-competitive. And funnily enough, in Europe now, there is talk about trying to get a group of food. So how can the food industry deal with this without government? Like, can they get into a room? Because the government obviously stops food companies pretty enthusiastically from talking to each other on competition rules. Mm. And there's now a question about, can you get people into a room to work out, like, what are the ground rules? What would we like as the basic regulations of stuff that it wasn't
The famous level playing field that corporations are so keen on.
Well, that's the problem. As you know, big corporations. So if you look at what's happening now with one of the reasons, and we'll go on to it, one of the reasons that we chose a tax in the end, and we recommended a fairly weighty salt and sugar tax, which is that the game playing that you can do with a lot of the regulations is very suited to big companies. So if you look, for example, at the ILN regulations, which is a restriction on promoting particular kinds of foods at the ILNs.
Yep.
There are all sorts of discussions now going on about how you work your way around that. So, for example, I would not be surprised if we saw in the cereal aisle what looked like an ILN, but in the middle of an aisle, advertising that stuff.
Right.
So the big companies tend to like some of these rules because they can get around them better than the smaller companies and
startups. Small shop couldn't do it at all. I think the government's probably given a carve-out for the smaller shops. But well, this idea that you can't promote so-called junk food, high in fat, sugar and salt, vast quantity of products, the idea that you can't have them near the entrance or near the exit, or near the end
shop,
of
the whole shop is in the exit, So they are different. You know, with any intervention, there are complexities and it's difficult. It's difficult to work out ways of that aren't gameable. You're always going to get gaming. And then the second thing is things like taxes. You've got a complex system, and so anyone would be lying if they said they knew what would happen if you put in a certain tax, or you know, no one knew with the sugary drinks levy exactly what was going to happen beforehand when it was brought in. But and if you were operating UK PLC as a private company, in our private companies, when we want to kind of change stuff, what we do is we play with price, we play with product, we play with displays, and we see what happens, and we do rapid testing. Mm-hmm. And it's very difficult when you're kind of dealing with a national thing and you've got, a tax. The sugary drinks levy, and any private company, if you've been introducing that, you would have introduced that, and then you would have tweaked it and changed it, and this isn't working, that's not working. But it's very hard to do all of that stuff. So the natural inertia in the system is pretty high. The natural resistance to change.
You've obviously worked in the food industry. There's the out of home sector rather than supermarkets, but nevertheless, you know the industry. Do you not feel a bit of sympathy for food companies who are producing food that most people wouldn't consider to be junk food? It just happens to go above the threshold for high fat, sugar and salt. And they can't, you know how difficult it is to launch a food product. The vast majority of food products die a death within weeks, if not maybe months. Putting it at the end of our very, very valuable space, because it lets people know, who are pretty conservative about what they buy. They put the same things in the basket every time. It's quite hard to get them even to try something, let alone buy it long term.
Yeah.
Don't you feel a bit of sympathy for these companies? They're not even allowed to put it at the end of the yard. The supermarkets have been told by the government, you can't put that there, you can't put that there, you've got to put this there. And they can't even advertise their products online any time, day or night, ever again. Doesn't this seem a bit heavy-handed to you? As somebody who, because Leon, let's face it, has plenty of products that are over the threshold.
Yeah, no, and in fact, and we had this discussion before, which was, it was when we started Leon, we had a kind of view about where we wanted to go, like what we wanted to be like. This kind of, we want to be fast food, but it's all fresh and does you good. And we realised as we did it, like the commercial pressures that pull you in the other direction, you know. Do you go for everything's good, or do you go for the best possible version of what people will eat, and you know how the market drags you in a certain direction?
The market being what people want.
Yeah, yeah, what people. But yeah, right. Yeah, yeah, what people will buy.
So the question is, do you give them tasty food, which is quite high in fat and salt, or do you give them food that's not so tasty?
Exactly.
And wants to buy it?
Exactly. Mm. And do you? So the question is, do you feel? Your question you asked was, do I feel sorry for? Or do I feel? And I think. You have to be, definitely, you don't do these restrictions for fun. You're not getting involved. And I think one of the problems with this debate in the past is that public health always came across as incredibly cross. So they always came across like they were telling you off and they didn't want you to have fun. And all the people, you know, the people...
You've met Graham McGregor, then?
Who is that?
Graham McGregor.
I haven't, actually.
On sugar. He's very much a sort of old-school Victorian.
Yeah, and actually a lot of the people in the public health system are kind of quite cross and not very sympathetic about people's lives and about, you know...
And certainly not business.
And not sympathetic about business. Business is bad. And we were very clear to say, look, it's not business being bad. Business is as stuck in this... in this cycle as anyone else. I went to talk to a cereal company the other day at their kind of annual strategy day, and they wanted me to talk about this, and I was kind of explaining what I thought the problem was, that all these companies, and this company actually had done pretty well, they had very few products in this space, and yeah, all of their new products are all their old product with chocolate in, their old product with sugar and glazed chocolate in. And they were like, yes, we don't want to do this stuff, but we're getting sucked into it in a way. There's like a kind of, everything is getting sweeter and sugarier and, you know.
Is it though? Is everything really getting sugarier and sweeter? It seems like it's going the other way.
Well, I think if you look in the kind of, in the categories that I've talked about, yes, they're growing and cereals are getting, you know, sugary and
not Cocoa Pops. It's been reformulated and apparently it tastes appalling then.
Does it? I'm not surprised because it was rice with brown stuff on it. It's need to take the sugar off.
You know, this is the future you want, isn't it? Horrible, tasteless food. Until people go back to the kitchens and make it themselves. Isn't that what people want, isn't it? You want women back in the house, cooking the food, spending a couple of hours a night over a casserole.
Well, I do all the cooking in my house. But,
men.
So. No, that isn't what I want. But I do think there are two. I do think there are two transitions that need to be made. So, you know, as you know, Italy and Spain have much less of the processed stuff than we do, or Germany do, or America do.
And less of the ultra processed stuff. Well, pretty keen on the processed stuff.
Well, I guess, yeah.
There you get
the definition of, you know, that's where the definitions, I think, break down on processed stuff. But if you're talking about stuff that is, you know, high
made
in sugar, fat, and salt.
Made by big companies.
High in sugar, fat, and salt. Mm-hmm. And so I do think that if you define the problem, let's stay away from the environment. If you define the problem as, if you believe, as I do, and as I think, you know, you can play the evidence both ways, but there's good evidence to suggest that diabetes might overtake cancer in terms of the cost of the NHS of treating it type 2. So if you believe that, let's not argue about the evidence, but if you believe that, then I think the solution has to be two things. One is you have to try and get people eating less of the high in sugar, salt and fat foods. And you can do that in two ways. You can get them cooking from scratch at home because the food you cook from scratch at home just isn't like that as much. Or you can make the bad stuff less bad for you, can reformulate. And you have to do one of those two things. I think, actually, though, that if the... I think you may see... I think there are two other ways in which it will happen, by the way. So, first of all, appetite drugs, which the kind of we want everyone to be back in the home cooking quinoa and eating pulses brigade really hate. But I think you may well see drugs that make people whose appetites are particularly susceptible to these things less appetite. So you break the cycle that way. Rather than breaking the food cycle, you change the appetite.
Cigarettes. Bring back the cigarette.
Bring back, well, does the vaping do it as well as the cigarette?
I suppose it does a bit, yeah.
But so that's one thing that you might see. And then the other is, when you talk now to the food companies, they're really thinking hard about how do we make stuff that doesn't have this effect. They don't like being seen as the new tobacco. It's not fun running a company like that. And they also know that it is a problem, so they're not in denial about it.
No, but they are faced, as you've kind of alluded to a couple of times already, they're faced with consumers who actually do want very tasty, high sugar, high fat, high salt food.
Yeah, well, they know that...
And ultimately, if you really succeed, I don't think you ever would, but if you succeed in really clamping down on all these companies and taxing the hell out of them, people would just go back to their homes and they'd start baking more cakes.
Well, no, because I think they will find ways of making things... They can
do
find
you?
Ways of making things delicious without just pumping up.
How are they going to do that? This is a holy grail, isn't it?
Yeah, but, you know, they've
failed so far.
I don't know.
Certainly with Cocoa Pops and Iron Brew.
I don't know how they'll do it, but they've only, you know, it's only been 30 years, 40 years that they've been doing this stuff. So I am, as you are, I'm sure, full of optimism for private ingenuity.
It would be fantastic if they could do it. I just don't see how they can overcome the kind of evolutionary urge to have high-calorie food. It's a perfectly sensible thing in evolutionary terms. Let me ask you about the salt tax thing, because I find this particularly interesting. I mean, salt doesn't have any calories in it. It's about the only part of the food supply that doesn't have any calories in it at all. It's a way to make food tastier without adding any calories, water. But you want to tax it, and I understand you'll probably say it's high blood pressure and all the rest of it. My understanding is that the evidence around what is an optimal amount of salt is pretty shaky, and it differs from person to person quite a lot. And a lot of the scare stories about salt over the years have been just that. And salt obviously is totally necessary for life in a way that sugar isn't. But also, are you not concerned maybe about unintended consequences here? That perhaps, and this is, I'm only putting this forward as a possibility, perhaps the drive to bring down salt levels over the recent decades has led to more obesity, because if you can't flavour something with salt, which doesn't add to the calorie load, you have to flavour it with something else, which does. And are we really certain enough about the science to be making these big interventions when no one even really knows why obesity's gone up in the last 40 years, really, let alone what the impact will be if you start messing around with very fundamental ingredients like salt? I'm almost invoking the precautionary principle there, which is a rare position to find yourself in. Well, before we let a load of public health people with half-baked ideas loose on the entire food supply, we should maybe consider that perhaps the status quo isn't all bad.
So I think there are two questions there. The evidence on kind of the healthiness or otherwise of salt. I felt that there was... So you're right, some people, salt's not an issue. If you have low blood pressure, for example, as I do, you don't need to worry too much about salt. There's a tiny risk of increase, but it's basically the link between salt and blood pressure that is high blood pressure. And there are people who have too little salt, but there are a lot of people who have high blood pressure and quite a lot of salt. And if you look at the benefits of reducing that, we felt that that was worth going for. In terms of the unintended consequences, you've always got to be aware of unintended consequences. So it is possible, for example, that on the sugar tax leads to much more sugar being replaced by sweeteners. And it turns out, there's no science in this at the moment, it couldn't be the case, that sweeteners trigger the appetite as much as
I've
sugar.
I've heard this. I don't think it's
true. I don't think it's true. But, I don't think there's convincing evidence for it yet, but who knows. And that is where this thing about you get stuck into two situations. You either get into a kind of precautionary principle, we're not going to do anything about it, we're just going to leave it until it gets really bad, because at some point people will do something about it, or you begin to experiment, trial, change things. Mm. And any action on a, I agree, any action on a big system will have...
Couldn't we let some other countries try it out and then learn from it?
Well, so actually, I think that's a really interesting point. So one of the only way in which you can experiment on these things is, particularly on taxes, is different countries trying things.
Yep.
And I think the flip side, if we were being serious about this as a world, you would actually be trying different things.
Hmm,
you'd
have
and that's actually, you know, COVID has been a fantastic example of that. It's like, there's been so much extra learning because people have behaved differently in different countries, mm-hmm. and we've been able to see what worked and what didn't work if we've kept our head about us.
Final question, because I think we're coming up to a half hour. We started off talking about the justification for government intervention. You've argued that there is definitely a case for government intervention in this particular area. I don't still agree, but I'll take your point. What then are the limits to that intervention? So how far are you prepared to go? Presumably you don't want to bring in ration books, which would presumably largely solve the problem. You don't want to tax people by their BMI, which would probably be a more effective way of taxing obesity than taxing random ingredients. So where would you draw the line and why?
So the argument we made was that you have to kind of experiment progressively, but you have to look at what, you know, in the end, if it's a political thing, you have to look at what you will be allowed to do by the public, what the public will see as an will stand for. And actually, we did a lot of focus groups with kind of swing voters, with voters in northern constituencies, with voters of different affluence. And it was really interesting the kind of the way sugar and interventions on sugar were viewed versus meat on the environment side, mm-hmm. like how you reduce meat. So when you talked about sugar, people see it as a bad thing. People are generally fed up with their kids being advertised stuff. They feel bad about themselves giving their kids, you know, sugary drinks. And they quite want, on the whole, they quite want state intervention on health. If you look at the sugary drinks levy, for example, is overwhelmingly popular. If you look at meat, I think it's not a government that, for example, brought in a meat tax, which would massively increase the cost of mince, as a percentage, more than it did fillet steak, if it didn't do a U-turn. I think it's not an exaggeration to say it would fall within...
Mm. It's interesting, you do say in the report, you say that the public won't stand for a meat tax, basically. But the implication is you'd quite like to have one. And you haven't given me any principled reasons where you draw the line.
No,
it just comes down to how you're prepared to go as far as the public will allow. Include ration books.
So you have to start by saying, like, so with meat, the problem with meat is that 70%, it's about land, not methane, by the way. 70% of our agricultural land is meat. The weight of all the animals we breed to eat is twice our weight and 10 times the weight of wild animals. There's no kind of solution to the climate change problem and to biodiversity that doesn't mean reducing meat by, say, 30%. The classic way to do that would be to tax carbon, put a carbon tax in properly, but the public wouldn't stand for that. And so as with energy, where you say, okay, the public's not going to stand for a carbon tax, we're going to have to subsidise alternative forms of energy, trying to get the prices to match up and then make the transition that way. I don't think that you can be about how you do the transition. I don't think you can have any principle other than look at what the most effective levers are from a kind of policy point of view and then match those against what is politically doable. I can't see any other way you could cut it.
But you must have personal preferences. Is there not any policy you would think would be too extreme? Let's stick to the obesity side rather than the climate change side. But for example, if we have BMI as part of your income tax, and every point above 25 of your BMI, you get taxed another £500, That would probably be quite effective, right? In getting people to lose weight.
But a lot of people
would say that is extremely discriminatory.
Yeah, discriminatory.
Uncivilized.
So you were assuming that the only outcome there is like if you were to have to reduce obesity or an asteroid would destroy the planet, you know, then. But you're not. You're playing that off against other things. I think that would be discriminatory. I think it would cause all sorts of, you know, societal anger. It would be very upsetting.
But let's say the majority of the public were behind it.
Okay. So, I guess I have quite a lot of faith in the public. So
really?
That's where we
differ, I think.
I have quite a lot of faith in it. But the focus groups that we did, I have quite a lot of faith in the public.
Focus groups always say what you want them to say. Particularly if it's about sugar, when they've been beaten over the head by Action on Sugar for the last 7 years, saying
they've been hypnotized.
Once you have Action on Meat around for a decade,
I think you overestimate the power of Action on Sugar, the reach of Action on Sugar to the general public. See, it's more when they talk about it, people talk about their kids, people talk about being in a shop and all the sugar there. They talk about it from personal point of view. They don't talk about it from what they've heard on the Action. No one listens, except for you and me. No one listens to
the news all the time. It was in the news yesterday, talking about baby food. We're recording this a week in advance, folks. But there they were saying that there needs to be mandatory guidelines on how much sugar can be in baby food. Mandatory guidelines. That's quite an Orwellian phrase, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm not sure what that means.
Well, I do. It's a ban.
What does it mean?
It's a ban.
Right.
Okay. Yeah, a ban on going above 1 teaspoon per 100 grams or whatever it may be. Henry, thank you very much for coming on
the show.
Thank you very much for watching. We'll be back in a couple of weeks. Don't know who it's going to be. Don't know where we're going to be. But from the Live with Littlewood set here in the heart of swinging London, thank you and goodbye.